Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Here lies Yahoo, 1994 to 2016, RIP. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdo. Monday, the 25th of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It is with a heavy heart we confirm the passing of Yahoo today, dead at 22. The proximate cause of death was changing times, complicated by mysterious strategic choices and an inability to adapt. Yahoo was born in 1994 as Jerry and David's guide to the World Wide Web. And in its early years, Yahoo was a superstar of Web 1.0, managed to survive the dot-com crash as well. Sclerosis settled in not long after, though, as the company struggled while Google and Facebook and The Times raced ahead of it. After a long illness, the end came mercifully quickly this morning when Verizon announced it's buying what's left of Yahoo's operating business for $4.8 billion. That is far, far, far less than the company was worth at the height of its powers. Mark Garrison has the Marketplace obituary.
Yahoo's 90s heyday was a time when getting on the internet meant hearing this sound. It seems impossibly quaint today when mobile, social, and streaming rule, but there was a time when people sat in front of desktop computers and read words on the internet. It was a mess to navigate in those early days. Yahoo seized an opportunity to categorize the web in a way that people could actually find something they wanted to check out. University of North Carolina business professor Arvind Malhotra remembers it well.
In the wild, wild west of the internet, it was the sheriff in town. People trusted it. It was the door to the whole world of the internet, the universe.
Yahoo racked up users and investors noticed. It exploded during the dot-com boom, hitting a market value of $130 billion in 2000. We all know how that era ended for most of Silicon Valley, but Yahoo managed to survive the crash. Then in 2001, it made a surprising move. It hired Terry Semel as CEO. He was a Hollywood guy, not a tech person. The pick crystallized the contradiction that dogged Yahoo until its dying day. Wharton School professor Kartik Osanagar explains.
Yahoo was always struggling to figure out, is it a media company? Is it a technology company? But it never could be clear on what it was.
While Yahoo spent time and money making content, new arrivals like Google and Facebook focused on selling ads against search and social. They made a killing and left Yahoo far behind. It tried pricey acquisitions and went through a parade of CEOs, including former Googler Marissa Meyer, but there was no hope. Yahoo, a tech giant when the internet traveled over pokey phone lines, now meets its whimpering end, swallowed by a phone company. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We'll get to the Democratic convention in a bit, the disunity that seems to be going on there today. But first, at root, at least most immediately, is the email hack that was all over the news this weekend. 20,000 or so Democratic National Committee emails that the authors would rather not have had become widely known. You roll that in with the Sony hack, also a big email event, and many, many instances of emails made unfortunately public, and you wonder why anybody uses it anymore. Gigi Duban looks at how the ways we email have changed.
People have been saying for years that email is going to die, that one day people are just going to stop using it. That's what people told Eva Galperin, global policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
And that came as an enormous surprise to me because I'm pretty sure I get more email, especially work-related email, than ever.
That despite increased use of social media apps and other messaging platforms, she says.
It's very deeply ingrained in business culture right now to have, email lists and email threads and records of all conversations so that you go back and you know what has happened.
But people doing things they shouldn't don't necessarily want those records. Galperin says they will often seek out more private ways of messaging, like Signal and WhatsApp. Or if you're like Richard Anthony, head of equity derivatives for BGC Financial, you've learned to be really terse.
I'm always, because of the industry that I'm in a very highly regulated industry. So you must be extremely careful about anything that you say.
His company trains employees to keep it professional, stay on point. And to many people, it doesn't matter that it's not private, says Gloria Mark. She studies people's use of technology at the University of California, Irvine. She says on average, people check email 74 times a day.
Similar to when you play a Las Vegas slot machine, every so often you're going to win, right?
So even if there's a risk, email could get you in trouble. She says people want to hit that email jackpot, like hearing from a long-lost friend. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Only checking email 74 times a day? Man, I should try to do that. All right. If this is Monday, Donald Trump must have said something provocative about the global economy. And sure enough, he did. On Meet the Press yesterday, the Republican nominee threatened to pull the U.S. out of the World Trade Organization if it didn't go along with his plans. The thing is, the WTO is the place that we, that is the United States, go to block unfair trade practices like the ones Mr. Trump complains about a lot. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer takes it from there.
Here's what Donald Trump said about the WTO on Meet the Press.
The World Trade Organization is a disaster. You
know, but it turns out the U.S. has had pretty good luck using the WTO to block China, says Howard Gleckman, a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center.
In at least three occasions in recent years, we have won cases in the WTO and gotten the Chinese to back off.
Without the WTO, we could go back to the bad old days, letting our ambassadors iron out trade disputes. How effective is that?
Not very.
Gary Huffbauer is a former trade negotiator, now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says there are so many more trade disputes than there used to be. Ambassadors would be overwhelmed.
Ambassadorial time is limited. They always have a lot of things on their plate.
Huffbauer says we could just raise the tariffs or taxes on foreign goods we import. Hey, even start a trade war. Peter Cohn is a research analyst with Height Securities.
A trade war, it may sound good and it may, you know, stir up populist feelings, but ultimately it's going to have a negative impact on the U.S. economy and ultimately cost jobs.
Because Cohn says other countries would raise tariffs on things we export to them. We'd export less, and jobs here would be lost. Huffbauer is also worried about that, but he says Trump calls himself a deal maker and may be counting on making deals so we wouldn't have to do things like leave the WTO. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Off day on Wall Street today, but not by a whole lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Democratic Convention is officially underway, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, as you know. That means another week of our pop-up podcast, Politics Inside Out, exploring the convention and politics and this economy as insiders and outsiders might see it. Our Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook, is on Independence Mall in Philadelphia. Hey, Andrea, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. There you stand in front of Independence Hall. Tell me, would you... I guess the mood, right? It's been a bit crazed today with the Sanders supporters, the ultimate outsiders, not so happy.
You know, Philadelphia is packed. I think the more crazy part was earlier today when I was in the convention center when the Bernie supporters were trying to get into a Bernie Sanders speech. There were literally thousands of people trying to get up a pair of escalators. This convention for them is a little bit of a morning session as well, because it's awake in some ways, because they understand from what Bernie has said that, you know, the party has to reach unity, or so they say.
Do you suppose that Senator Sanders has miscalculated the potency of his insider-outsider argument, right? Because that was the argument he's been making for a year on the campaign trail, and now here he is at the convention, and it seems like he can't control his supporters.
I think the Democratic Party as a whole misjudged it. And I think that is what we are seeing by this sort of email kerfuffle. These are people who think of Hillary Clinton as an insider, and they think of Bernie Sanders as an outsider, whatever the truth may be on either of them. And they are upset at how much the structure itself has tried to tip the whole game towards the insider candidate.
Talk to me for a minute about the Republican outsiders from last week and the Democratic outsiders from this week and where their common ground might lie.
That's the most surprising thing, Kai, about this convention, is that when I talk to the quote-unquote outsiders, the people who consider themselves outsiders here at the Democratic Convention, the people who are super Bernie supporters, what they really care about is the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is the, you know, the big, huge trade deal that they call the NAFTA of the 21st century. They do not want it to go through. That rings exactly like what Donald Trump is saying about trade on his side. And there's amazing overlap. And again, this speaks to what you and I have been talking about now for more than a week, which is that it's not left-right anymore. It's insiders and outsiders. Mm-hmm. And these people feel as though they are outsiders in the global economy. The party loyalty is showing cracks on both sides.
Andrea Seabrook is our Washington bureau chief. The podcast that she is running now out of Philadelphia for the next couple of three-ish days is called Politics Inside Out. You can get it on our webpage, which is, of course, marketplace.org. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Andrea, we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Kai.
We've got a series we do every now and then in which you ask and we answer questions about all things economic, big or small. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes to us from a listener in Cork, Ireland.
My name is Dara McNally, and I've always wondered how authors get paid when libraries use their books.
Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one for us.
I'm in the Los Angeles Central Library to get to the bottom of Dara's question. Now, this downtown library isn't as quiet as you might expect on a weekday morning. Lots of kids running around, people sitting at the more than 300 computers set up for public use. And yes, some folks are actually reading physical books, you know, with paper. I ran into Marco Marin at a kiosk in the lobby. He was trying to find a couple of books. He says he comes here to check out books at least once a week. Marco's Poison?
Your basic zombie story, kind of the world ending through zombies.
Marco agreed to let me take a walk with him to find the books in the stacks, but he also told me he's downloaded some ebooks. I asked Marco if he knows how the libraries get copies of the books he's constantly checking out from publishers and authors.
I actually did think about that the other day. I never got to the bottom of it, but I have always wondered how is it that that works. Like, I mean, they get published, obviously, they get money. I'm assuming when it comes down to libraries that they would donate some?
Actually, it's pretty simple. The libraries buy the books from the publishers. And depending on the size of the library and the popularity of the book, a library might buy a particular title by the case.
One has to look back at sort of the history of public libraries.
Julie Tenero is president of the American Library Association. She explains the funding is basically provided through taxes.
Items are purchased for use by all based on the model that people have prepaid for this. In fact, I always used to laugh and say, you know, yes, libraries are free, but they really are prepaid. Odds are you've paid for it in your taxes in some way.
So the taxpayer is paying for the library books.
Then, of course, the relationship between an author and his editor or his publisher, that's where the author's money comes from.
And the author works out a different royalty price for each different sale. Mark Shaw's written more than 20 books and says he gets a certain amount of money if his publisher sells his book to a retail store and a different amount if it's sold to a library.
Sure, there's some authors who are going to be a little bit disturbed by the royalty amount or whatever, but there's a great part of the population that can't afford books. And so they can go to the library, they can check out a book, it doesn't cost them anything. I know I sound like a cheerleader for libraries, and it's not just because my wife is a librarian, But I really believe that that's one of the staples of our society is libraries.
But that staple is changing. The LA Public Library has a lot of tangible books, but it's shifting a lot of its book budget to more of a hybrid model with ebooks and audio. So another question to consider is how authors get compensated for every time someone clicks on a title to check it out from the library on their phone. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We need your help on this one. Send us your questions about anything at all, really. We'll see what we can do. There's a space you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Both my sisters live in London, so I feel a little bit of pity too, but it's very obvious.
London's loss might be Berlin's Brexit gain, but first, let's do the numbers. After weeks of record highs, the market's pulled back a bit today. The Dow Industrial's off 77 points, about 0.4%, 18,493. The NASDAQ nudged down 2 points, less than 0.1%, 5,097. The S&P 500 dropped 6 points, about 0.3%, 2,168. We've already marked the death of Yahoo with a proper eulogy. Investors were resigned to the company's fate as well. Yahoo shares off 2.7%. Acquirer Verizon dropped 0.4% today. Nintendo, as you might have heard, has won tons of publicity for the hugely popular Pokemon Go app, and the company's shares skyrocketed after the game's release. Sadly, however, Nintendo owns only a third of the company that makes Pokemon. It said sales of the app were already built into current forecasts, and that sent Nintendo shares down 17% today. You're listening to Marketplace. It's kind of sad, huh? This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have said in one of their rare moments of agreement that should they win in the fall, they would invest in this country's infrastructure. That'd probably be a good thing to do because the roads and the bridges here and all the rest of it aren't getting better by themselves. In fact, in some parts of the country, people are doing something called depaving their roads. Ariane Marshall wrote about it for Wired. Ariane, good to talk to you.
Nice to be here.
You have to explain depaving to me. Is it what it sounds like?
It's exactly what it sounds like. It means taking a formerly paved road and ripping it up. And sometimes you put down some dirt, sometimes you put down some gravel. Depends on the situation, but just kind of getting rid of that pavement.
And you went up to Montpelier, Vermont. You spoke to people up there. And apparently the city is doing it because it's too expensive to keep the roads paved.
Yeah. So this actually happened back in 2009, and they were really suffering a big funding shortfall that year, I think as many American towns and cities do. Yeah. And they decided it just was more cost effective to rip up their pavement and put down some gravel than deal with the really kind of broken up pavement they had.
Hmm. All right. So speaking of broken up, let's break this down a little bit. So they go and they chew up this whatever the road coating is. They leave it there. But there are some downsides, right? I mean, it's dusty and it's a bumpy ride, and right?
It's not ideal for cars. I spoke to someone who runs a car maintenance store, and she was telling me that a lot of folks end up trading in their planet-friendly Priuses for SUVs.
Oh, no.
Because this is really kind of tough on cars. But actually, on balance, it's probably better overall than driving across a bunch of potholes all the time.
Yeah, well, that's the point, right? It's ginormous potholes or a little bit of bounciness.
Exactly.
You do point out that even though spending on infrastructure has risen somewhat, it's the costs of concrete and asphalt and all that stuff that has risen more, right?
That's right, yeah. And since 2003, the budgets have gone up, but the price of those raw materials have gone up so much that actually the spending on transportation infrastructure has gone down in total by 9% since 2003.
We ought not be surprised because, as you point out in this article, the Association of Civil Engineers gives our infrastructure in this country a D. Bridges and roads are, as we all know, in terrible condition. Even though this seems like an extreme solution, it can't be surprising.
Absolutely. We're not in a great place in terms of funding for infrastructure in this country. The really kind of interesting thing about this story is that it's happened in 27 states, but it hasn't been anything that's top down. It's just that a number of agencies have decided on their own that ripping up pavement is the best way to make use of what little money they have.
Ariane Marshall is a staff writer at Wired on its transportation desk. Ariane, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
After the Brexit vote last month, a German political party hired a truck to drive around London with a big giant billboard on its sides, urging startup companies in the UK to, and this is a quote, keep calm and move to Berlin, end of quote. Clever, but that was then. This is now. The past 7 days have seen four deadly attacks in Germany that have left 10 people dead, dozens more injured. It's reasonable to believe some businesses that might have considered a move are thinking twice. Ditto France after Paris and Nice. All of that said, though, capitalism is a powerful motivator, so the sales pitches will likely go on. Lizzie O'Leary, the host of our weekend program, is just back from a couple of weeks in Europe, including a stop in Berlin, looking at that city's efforts to woo London businesses and talent in kind of an economic land grab.
To successfully pull off an economic land grab, you basically need two things: jobs and people.
Tell me where we are. We're like standing in this giant courtyard here. Where are we?
Of course, we're right in the center of Berlin in Mitte.
A place where Simon Schaefer is trying to create hundreds of jobs. He's the founder and CEO of Factory, which is sort of a tech accelerator, co-working space, and startup network rolled into one.
We dub it Silicon LA.
Of course you do.
Of course we do.
And we're walking across the street from his office here in the Mitte district of Berlin to a new building that his company is renovating.
This left side will be a coffee shop dash beer bar. And on first floor, it's office space for a larger tech company. Second floor will be co-working.
The third and fourth floor are already bustling. A social network for scientists is in that space already. And on top, apartments for people who are going to want to live in this little hive of tech activity. We go up to a balcony overlooking the city. And Schaefer, who advises the European Commission on technology issues, is feeling pretty good about Germany's position in the tech world right now.
So you must have watched the Brexit vote with a little bit of, is it exaggerating to say Schadenfreude?
Not at all. I think Schadenfreude is an interesting term for that. Both my sisters live in London, so I feel a little bit of pity too, but it's very obvious. You know, all the things that are going for a unified Europe from an entrepreneurship perspective, right? If you look at every single piece of legislation that is focusing on growth in Europe, it's usually about the digital space and how to unify that across borders and how to be competitive against the superpowers in the internet, China and USA.
He thinks, and yes, of course, it's in his interest to say so, that startups will come to Berlin, to Paris, to any place where they have access to the European single market. That's something that a British-based company can't guarantee without EU membership. That means a lot of places are trying to lure business right now. A financial lobbying group in Frankfurt has been promoting the city to foreign banks. The French prime minister said he wants Paris to be the center of finance in Europe. One thing that could stand in the way? Taxes. Germany's corporate tax rate is roughly 30%. France, 33%. Britain, only 20%. And then there is that other thing you need to make your land grab a success: people. Thousands of people, most of them young, lined up by the Brandenburg Gate to watch Germany play France in soccer in the Euro Cup semifinals recently. And it was a bit like a small European Union. People from Germany, France, Belgium, Portugal, and yes, the UK. Like this guy, Ben Dow.
My name is Ben. I'm 29, and I'm working and studying here.
Before the Brexit vote, he was planning on going back to the UK, but now...
I'll stay here. Yeah. Well, I'll apply for a German passport and I'll stay.
Remember, his generation has known nothing but a united Europe, where they can work, study, and travel anywhere within its boundaries. And that's something that Germans want to keep.
We have more than 90% backing this idea of having an integrated Europe.
Peter Mateschek is one of the most accurate pollsters in Germany. He says Germans see Brexit as Britain's loss, not theirs. Mateschek also found that Germany's Eurosceptic party, the AfD, lost support, while Angela Merkel's party gained it.
Brexit had an effect on voters in Germany insofar as they rallied around the governing parties, especially the Christian Democrats.
And that means that a policy of open borders and open doors for people and companies is pretty much here to stay in Germany. In Berlin, I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
This Final note on the way out today, in which changes are coming to your local Starbucks. The company is out with a new dress code. There's an official lookbook and everything. In it, we learn hair coloring is now okay, didn't used to be. Fedoras are apparently fine, but not bucket hats with patterns. Slouchy ski caps, yes, but not if they have a pom-pom. Shorts work, but not leather pants. Socks with a pop of color are fine, but not if they distract from your outfit. So, now you know. All right, quitting time. The Dow off a little bit today. 77 points, 0.4%, 18,493. The NASDAQ down 2 points, less than a 10%. 5,097. The S&P 500 down 6 points, about a 3rd percent, 2,168. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. We're talking about politics from the inside out this election season. We're bringing your questions inside the conventions and taking a look at what these political developments mean outside in our lives and livelihoods, all in our new pop-up podcast that's called Politics Inside Out. Get it on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.